session 8, side 3, July 10th, 2006. And we're talking about organic, mechanical, and the loop. And you were saying about the loop?
Yeah. All right. If media are technological extensions, which when we engage with those technological extensions with our senses, it creates a closed loop. McLuhan says it creates a closed loop. Now, what I'm thinking is that means that we're tightly coupled with that media extension. And what I mean by that is that I think what it does is it creates a reality tunnel so that your reality becomes exclusive to your relationship with that media extension that you're engaging with, and as a part to other possible reality tunnels you could be experiencing. And there's two parts to that media extension. There's the form and the content. And the form creates a context for the content. And the form of the media, whether we're talking about book, newspaper, radio, or television, the form is stable, but the content is mutable. You can put any content into that context or that form. And in addition to book, newspaper, radio, and television, today under satellite conditions, we actually have the interplay of the book, newspaper, radio, and television under satellite conditions. So I'm saying we're tightly coupled with that media interplay, and it creates a reality tunnel.
Right. Now, the words reality and the words coupled are products of our time. Reality may be an earlier term, but to talk about coupling is an effect of you being acquainted with the computer form, computer technology, or even the idea of feedback that comes in when you're taping people or when you're on the telephone. So the terms you use to describe our present are products of our media present.
Mm-hmm.
So McLuhan's point about expanding on the idea of a feedback loop, media appear to be organic, or no, he would say that electric media are organic and mechanical media, hardware media, are not organic. And the reason electric media are organic is that they appear to be able to conduct a dialogue with us. We can talk to it, it can talk back. And that appears to be human-like. So in the 20th century, media appear more human-like, and then we would think, oh, they're us. And I already probably said this on the previous side, but it might have been leading somewhere that we didn't get to when we got cut off. But you want to respond to that notion?
I think we've sort of finely tuned the idea. I don't have anything else to add to it.
Well, it's just that the idea that he says, as long as we adopt the narcissist's attitude of regarding the extensions of our own bodies as really out there and really independent of us, we will meet all technological challenges with the same sort of banana skin pirouette and collapse. The whole thing about...
Sure, you have to see outside of a system in order to... like, the brain can never comprehend itself. But if you were operating in some para-brain metaphysical reality, you might be able to see the what's going on within the system of the brain from a new context. Then
yeah,
you might
but don't
be
use the word see. That's an American, you know, British bias.
Well, understand.
Yeah. See, if you're saying see, then people think you're just seeing it, but you can hear it or you can feel it. Proprioceptive.
Yeah. The point being, when you're engaged within a closed system, you can't see really all the parameters of how that system's working. So you're probably going to make...
Let me just deal with those words. McLuhan said that media create closed sensory systems. That's what you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
And then you're calling that also, other words with the same meaning, is a feedback loop.
Yeah.
Means closed system.
And you'd have to be in a metaphysical system that contextualizes that system in order to see how the system works and to avoid making the stupid mistakes that are intrinsic within working within a system that you don't know the parameters of.
Well, how do you compare all those words you just said with the idea of just turning it off? or the fact of just turning it off, then you'd be in another metaphysical system and see what you were in.
Yeah, there you go. That's right.
Right. So, in I'm detecting that you're going into a lot of abstract concepts when we're talking about our senses.
Yeah, but we're not going to turn it off. And McLuhan was able to go into a. McLuhan was able to step outside of the system and look at it from some other viewpoint, and then he could describe the system that everybody was inside of but couldn't see the parameters of.
Yeah, do you know how he did that?
Well, he didn't do it by turning it off. Maybe he did it by participating in different media, moving from one media to another, to another, to another.
Yeah, yeah. Or by reading different fields, not just English, which is what he was a teacher of. He read psychology, sociology, art history, science, novels, detective fiction. He read a lot of different things. They used to say that he had read everything.
So you have to become comprehensive.
Yeah. So he was helped by Wyndham Lewis. Now, Wyndham Lewis was the one who began to see this stuff. You know, that's what's interesting, is that Lewis... It's one of the first humans to kind of see this.
What label is attached to Wyndham Lewis? Was he a, what was he? He wasn't a, was he a poet, or what was it?
No, he was originally a painter, but after World War One, he retreated, and he wrote this huge 1,000-word opus called Man of the World, and then he couldn't get it published, so he chopped it up into several books and novels in the second half of the 20s, so he became known as a philosopher, critic, and novelist. He still kept painting. And so he was a writer, and he's a writer and a novelist. A writer and a painter is basically what he is historically.
Mm-hmm.
And he kind of wrote science fiction, some of his novels, and a very sophisticated science fiction, not seen as normal science fiction. So he was a polymath.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's a modern word, right? People use that word.
Okay.
So that's Lewis, Wyndham Lewis. He was born the same year as James Joyce, and James Joyce made him a major antagonist, alter ego in Finnegan's Wake.
Hmm. So, because
he learned a lot from Lewis, and Lewis learned a lot from him.
But you said he made him a protagonist or an antagonist?
Mainly on the surface level, the competing twin brothers Shem and Sean. Lewis was Sean and Joyce was Shem, and so they were competing rivals.
So he didn't agree with Lewis. He wrestled with him because he thought Lewis didn't have the complete idea.
Yeah, well, no, Lewis Lewis historically is known as the only guy who came up with a critique of Pound, Eliot, Joyce, and Gertrude Stein, and what was known as the modernist movement, and Picasso. He's the only one who tried to have an outside view of it, even though he knew all these people. And
but
so
Joyce, Joyce critiques Lewis.
Yes, and Lewis smeared, really went after Joyce, and that's the ongoing argument.
Mm. But in Marshall's mind, he seems to prop up Joyce, so he must think Joyce wins the argument.
No, that's a complex issue. He propped up Lewis.
Oh.
But people think of him as a Joycean, but... there's the 50s, what he did in the 50s with the two of them, and then he changed in the 60s, and there's reasons why. And on a simple level, Finnegan's Wake, the way it was written was way more useful to describe the mixed corporate media world than anybody who wrote a novel in one language, which is what Lewis did, right?
Mm-hmm.
Even though, in his Chaldermass novel I mentioned in 1928, and Finnegan's Wake was just being serialized at the time in a journal, and was not even known as Finney's Way. It was called Work in Progress. Lewis adopted the techniques of Joyce's Finneganese and incorporated it into the Chaldermass novel. He was that on top of it that he could use it.
Oh.
And satirize Finneganese. And most people weren't even aware of it, aware of even what Joyce was writing. If they were, they didn't know what to make of it. So Lewis was a pretty interesting character.
Wow.
And it's like McLuhan used to say... to understand me, you got to understand James Joyce. I would say if you want to understand McLuhan, you have to understand Wyndham Lewis. And the best way to do that is to read McLuhan's student, Sheila Watson, and her thesis on Wyndham Lewis. That's the way to understand McLuhan and Lewis, because she wrote the thesis under McLuhan's guidance. And she was 50 years old when she did that. Mm-hmm. She was a famous Canadian novelist at the time.
Wow.
It was in the late 50s, early 60s.
Mm-hmm.
That's an interesting story, but I'm just hoiking up the importance of Wyndham Lewis. I mean, McLuhan is on tape when he was asked, where did he get this media knowledge from? He said, Wyndham Lewis.
Mm-hmm.
Not James Joyce, Wyndham Lewis. But he met Wyndham Lewis during the war. That's the important thing.
Mm-hmm.
When Lewis exiled himself and came back to Canada in the middle of World War II,
mm-hmm.
or at the beginning of World War II.
What was the
matter of fact, here's an interesting, you know, I call it God's eye view. The day Lewis left England, first week of September 39 when the war broke out, was the day that McLuhan arrived in England to spend a year at Cambridge on his honeymoon, first year of marriage, after being on his honeymoon in August 39. Isn't that interesting?
Mm-hmm.
One guy leaves, the other guy comes into London.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, that's a side thing. Let's go on to the... Unless you want to say more about the loop, let's do the next quote, because we've only done two quotes so far.
What was the woman's name again who did that thesis?
Sheila Watson.
Okay.
W-A-T-S-O-N.
All right. Okay. Moving forward with the reading. Go ahead.
This is the third quote on page 11 is from Take Today. A book came out in 1972. Co-authored by Barrington Nevitt with McLuhan.
Mm-hmm. So we're moving from 1964 to 1972, so there's probably been an evolution in thinking here.
Right, that's right. You'll see the rest of the quotes on the page are years after Understanding Media. So we have these first two quotes, which are introductory and dealing with private capitalism and ownership in relation to the tribalizing effect of electric media. So the next quote is...
Marx shared with economists...
That's Karl Marx.
Karl Marx shared with economists, then and since, the inability to make his concepts include innovational processes. It's one thing to spot a new product, but quite another to observe the invisible new environments generated by the action of the product on a variety of pre-existing social grounds.
Yes, so in the early 30s, when Keynes came up with Keynesian economics, which helped set up the welfare states around the world, he did not foresee the effects of radio. He did not see what was going to happen in Germany in the later 30s. So it is one thing to spot a new product, but quite another to observe the invisible new environments generated by the action of the product, so let's say generated by radio, on a variety of pre-existing social grounds. That's what we were talking about half an hour ago, about what you were calling human greed and identity, or human nature. And I was saying, well, those were pre-existing media. And new media threatens the human community and their media, which are older. Another phrase for that is pre-existing social grounds. So to see the effect of the communication that goes on from a new product's environment on previous forms of communication, that's what we're talking about here.
Mm-hmm.
And so Marx, he did not see the services and disservices of an innovational process, which is another word for a new media.
Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so he was... working within limitations which made his economic theories, would you say, implausible for the new media context?
It made it, it's interesting, he was adopted by the retrieval of medieval society in the Soviet Union, and Marx, McLuhan said, described the 18th century world, the 1700s. Not the 19th century world, the 1800s. He said Marx, when he discussed the coming communization of technological environments or of the means of production, McLuhan said that by 1830, before even Marx started to write the Communist Manifesto, there already were communistic environments in the hardware services of railway and newspaper and whatever other public services were happening then, because McLuhan said these hardware services were available for very little coinage to all levels of the class structure. So, you know, sort of making the definitions not as precise, like we were saying about smudging the definition of ESP, he smudges the meaning of access to hardware environments and calls them communists before even the communist movement showed up. And so when Marx was describing the class structure and the problems between the proletariat and the bourgeoisie, that actually was the Gutenberg phase of the 1700s, which led to the French Revolution.
Well, so Marx was not meeting the demands of the of his day and
that's
his,
right.
the new media environment, and his theories then were unworkable. Why did he rise to prominence and become archetypalized?
Because when radio, when the electric telephone, movie, automobile, and the radio came in, it retrieved non-industrialized, semi-industrialized cultures' remembrance of their tribal past, their oral culture, tribal culture, a culture of non-private property. Now, Russia was slightly industrialized in the 1900s, in the 1800s, at least in the latter part of the 19th century, the later 1800s. I mean, it was beginning to be industrialized under Count Witte, W-I-T-T-E, which LaRouche celebrates, Count Sergei Witte, and whatever czar was, one of the Nicholases probably, was running the show then. And, you know, it was the Russian Navy in the 1860s that protected Abraham Lincoln in the Civil War. You know, they were out there moving about. I mean, that was the Crimean War in the 1850s. Russia was beginning to surface now. So it's moving into the, you know, industrial environment of France and and England in the late 1800s. Then you bring in radio, and it retrieves the acoustic sensibility, the tribal culture, which was prominent all over the Soviet Union because only the cities like Moscow areas were industrialized. Just as tribalism was retrieved in the less industrialized Germany and the less industrialized Italy and the less industrialized, in the American sense or British sense, and the less industrialized Japan, this retrieval of acoustic culture, who is the, and they are a literate society, so who's the literate guy who's just talking about a kind of tribal ideology, a communistic, a group, a sharing of workers, and the means of production is Marx.
So the fact that scholars wanted to prop Marx up and
retrieve him, or
then was a mass hallucination, because they were all suffering from the illusion of the retrievals of acoustic culture.
Right, let's not call it hallucination, let's call it sensory fill-in, because there's some kind of material sensory process going on here on a collective level. It's a hallucination, it's not a fantasy.
But it was, in terms of economic viability, it was a fallacy, and everybody wanted to believe it and try to make it work, but it wasn't really going to work under present-day conditions.
Yeah, because of the collective identity crisis. When you have an identity crisis, you want to retrieve an old identity or forge a new one. Both processes are violent in relation to what's causing the identity crisis. So the Soviet Union retrieved a book person who had concepts that resonated with their need to retrieve an old oral cultural image.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so it's interesting. You know, I object a bit to using the idea of hallucination, but I think if you use the word hallucination, people will say, well, it's not real.
Well, yeah, I see that. No, that was interesting the way you fine-tuned it in terms of filling in I don't know how you said it exactly, but that was very good.
Yeah.
Because it makes it a material process. You can really see.
And when I say senses, I mean material. Interchangeable. It's what people call reality. You know, it's our knowable cognitive processes. A sense is a cognitive process. So we're discussing cognitive processes, and you can predict them. It's called the empirical method. We can predict, if you introduce radio into a situation that that Russia was, you will get what it became. Now, you couldn't say that in 1920. Now, Wyndham Lewis started to notice this stuff. It's very interesting. In an early groping way, but we have the advantage of, you know, 100 years later of being able, in retrospect, to say what happened. The thing is now, okay, can we apply that to what are the effects of the Internet or what are the effects of whatever environment's being built around us right now? That's how we would be viable media ecologists. But we can look at history and what's happened with the media, with the idea that media is the catalyst. And it's empirical and real. We can use examples from history, like Innes and McLuhan did, to develop a kind of science.
Mm-hmm.
That's what McLuhan's offering, as opposed to LaRouche, who says, don't get obsessed and turn the effects into a fetish. Just keep making better technology.
Sure, and that's a workable solution also.
Yes, and is it a workable solution? It is an attractive solution.
Mm-hmm.
It seems reasonably well-founded.
Yeah. Well, I think LaRouche sees technology as being organic as well, because
yes.
I was reading ahead, and I think he says that if you pull human beings out of the ecology would collapse, because the technological ecology created by human beings is actually supporting the ecology of the physical world. So
that's right. Humans are in the interval there. And so that's why, you know, LaRouche, on my chart, you got LaRouche, McLuhan, Thompson, Croker, they all look at machines as sort of part of us and real.
Mm-hmm.
And that's different from what most people were thinking in the 50s and 60s and 70s. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Do we
associate Adam Smith with the archetype of capitalism?
Yes.
So would we say that he was more successful in creating a system of economics that would work within the new media context more so than Marx, since capitalism seems to have temporarily won out over communism?
Adam Smith's concepts built on Locke and private property and free trade reflect the cultural bias of Gutenberg industrialized people. Marx reflects the bias of less industrialized, less Gutenbergized people. You see what I mean?
Yes, I do.
Adam is America, British, Adam Smith, and Europe. That's more the I culture, whereas Latin America, Soviet Union, China are ear cultures, just for simple, broad demarcations, right? Definitely the fragmenting, visual, kinetic nature of industrial culture is matched best by the Adam Smith philosophy.
So is there
But here's an interesting point. Adam Smith became irrelevant by the turn into the 20th century when we're under the communistic, well, let's say group effect, the collectivizing effect of collective electric media all around the world, which are having different cultural content responses. Russia goes Marxist. Germany and Italy go fascist. America goes welfare state, and Britain, they go welfare state. And Keynes comes in as the preferred model.
Mm-hmm.
But by the 1970s, Keynesian economics doesn't work, so Adam Smith comes back in, and the neocon Republican Party free trade economic standby is based on Adam Smith.
Mm-hmm.
They retrieve Adam Smith. Now, I would
again,
say that,
retrieving an unworkable system because the sensory matrix is pushing us in that direction.
It works for Americans, but Americans don't exist in when you look at the Android meme and where we live today. But for the culture that thinks it's America, the fragmenting, individualizing, hyper-individualizing effect of digital media makes everyone think that they're on their own and they got to forge their own way and nobody should interfere with them. Because when you're in the Android meme and have your own computer, you're not being, it seems, impeded by other media. You can network whatever way you want. The visually biased concepts of Adam Smith are retrieved. And so it seems to be appropriate to the American sensibility. But in the Android meme, every sensibility is in touch with everybody else's meme and sensibility. And that's a pretty chaotic situation to the point you now have a president who can create global harmony by not speaking.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a further complexity, but I'm saying that when you say that it is inappropriate. It's you're forgetting that. Yes, it's inappropriate on a global scale or a solar level, or an intergalactic Andromeda level. But it is appropriate for the Americans, just as what the Chinese leaders do in China is the models that they agree on for their culture inside the global theater, right?
Right.
And looking at these figure grounds is the tetradic management.
But the international bankers are working outside of both the American and the Chinese model, I guess, or the international mobsters or whatever.
Yeah, they're working with ancient technology, the ownership of cash and gold, and maintaining that old medium in relation to all these other media. And like McLuhan said, the bankers have sat on the sidelines of the basic civil war between all the other modern media that's been going on in the last 100 years.
Mm.
But it's like the visual sense. Remember, the visual sense...
Well, So we have the bankers maintaining their gold wealth and sitting on the sidelines. Is there a more powerful group that is actually in the game and working the system to create wealth that goes beyond the bankers and the gold wealth?
Yeah, the users and content of electric media.
Well, I'm a user and content of electric media.
And so, I mean, Dan Rather, as George Bush said in 92 when he was running against Dan Rather, well, you're more powerful than me.
Oh.
And
That proved to be wrong. They killed Dan Rather, didn't they?
No, first of all, Bush got killed because Dan Rather embarrassed him the weekend before the election. And even though this is nebulous, what causes what, but it is political wisdom that Bush's image was destroyed by some questions by Dan Rather the weekend before the election. That's why Clinton won.
Mm.
So Dan Rather did knock off Bush, but centralized media people like Dan Rather are totally obsolete in this decade. So Dan Rather goes down later. You know what I mean? I mean, back then it was the electronic television government versus the old Washington bureaucracy. Bush lost. But when you bring in the Android meme and the internet two-way digital reality of today and relate that to confront Dan Rather of old centralized electric TV body stuff, he's going to lose, right?
Mm-hmm.
And he's losing against the effects that the internet media created. Remember, what are the effects? The effects of the internet media.
Technically he lost because he didn't check his facts, and he admitted to it. He brought a story forward, and he couldn't, even if the story was true, there were certain facts he didn't check, and he did the banana peel pirouette.
But who caused that? The internet media called the Swift Boat people. Wasn't that their term?
Yeah.
It was those guys who made up, many people say, totally fallacious information about Kerry and were ready to pounce on anything that New York media, centralized media said, and they operated in some weird zone, we'll call it the digital chip body zone, and they had more leverage, and people were amazed at this fantasies that the Swift Boat people, Swift Boat veterans, whatever they were able to come up with several issues that apparently helped Bush be reelected. That is an
We're talking about data information pirates, really.
Yes,
I mean, this is the new ocean of information, and these are the pirates.
The ocean of information is the clone DSP TV body. The pirates feeding on the TV body are the chip body people.
Mm-hmm.
That's what my chart means. That's the Rumpelstiltskins,
mm-hmm.
hijacking old TV body landscapes.
Mm-hmm.
And in the political context, it's just some well-funded group that send out a pattern through the non-mainstream media, the what's called the angry talk radio network of Rush Limbaugh and those guys, plus the blogs. That barrage was the main factor turning out the return of George Bush, the younger.
Mm-hmm.
So there's where you bring in media dynamics and talking about the effect of what's happening now on older media.
Mm-hmm.
So how did we get on to Dan Rather? We were talking about century profiles. What was it we were just saying 5 minutes ago.
Mm.
Marx, we're talking about Marx, and then...
yeah, and then we jumped to Adam Smith, and then Keynes,
and then Smith.
The retrieval of Adam Smith.
Yes, and the reality... Oh, yeah, we're talking about the international bankers, and them sitting on the sidelines.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I wanted to say this, is that the visual sense is the only one that can operate outside of the other senses, or appear to be. It's the detached sense. It can isolate. It's not as involved modality as sight, as hearing, touch, and kinesis are. So the detachment of the visual sense, and then extend that through the.
So it can be used. It can be used in the persuasive sense. Or is it the rhetorician who's persuasive? The visual sense can be manipulated to persuade the other senses. Because it's not so coupled with the other senses.
Only in the Gutenberg medium. See, in the Gutenberg extension of the sense, that enhanced the separation of the visual sense
mm-hmm.
outside of the matrix of
right.
the other senses. That put the abstract visual fulcrum of banking in control. But in the 20th century, the electric media bring the isolation of the visual sense back into its fold.
Yeah.
And so the historical media of the visual space dominant period, the Gutenberg galaxy, the bankers, end up sitting inside the retrieved tactile holism that electric media bring in, and therefore they don't have private ownership of money. They give you the money. That's where the New Deal comes in, and then the credit. The population gets to share and own the money.
Mm-hmm.
And the whole historical structure and meaning of private ownership, and you being Scott and me not being Scott, that identity which wealth is based on, that private property, becomes sidelined and marginalized. And yet it is still a medium. It's still there. So this is how we look at the idea that the bankers are conspiring. They're not. They're on the margins. An obsolete, separated visual Gutenberg effect still there as part of us.
Yeah, but look at how powerful they are. I heard you brought this up offline a couple weeks ago, and I heard this woman talking about the fact that $3 trillion turned up disappearing from the military industrial budget.
No, that was the Pentagon on September 10th, the day before September 11th.
Right.
Rumsfeld announced that $2.3 trillion was missing from the Pentagon budget.
Well, here's where she thinks that money went. It was, since the dollar was dropping in value compared to other currencies, the money was shipped outside of America, invested in other currencies, and while the dollar drops, then you can come back in and use that same money to buy up American wealth at a lower price at a fire sale. So money is very powerful.
No, there is no money, and the reason. And so she.
Private ownership is powerful, and private ownership is linked to the exchange of gold and money.
Private ownership is not as it's one of the five senses, and its media extensions are one of the five extended spaces. It is orchestrated among the five. It is as powerful on the level of 20%, and that is the fact that you have a private identity, and this is very strong in the West. And it's powerful in the West, but it's not powerful in the East, but or non-Westernized cultures. But
here's where it becomes powerful.
Let me finish. This is important. The non-Westernized cultures, because they are threatened by the TV body and the chip body, which gives them no even tribal identity, they are putting on private Western identity as a costume, just as Westerners are putting on other cultural identities, like identifying with shamanism, as an ersatz, a fake anti-environment, to the fact that no identity is possible under this situation.
Mm-hmm.
So what were you going to say?
Well, you know, if they can effectively collapse the U.S. economy by siphoning off U.S. dollars monetary wealth, come back in and buy up the country and start controlling the country and possibly collapsing the economy. when you and I are out of work, that may not apply to you, but when we're out on the streets trying to figure out how to survive, that all these discussions about wealth and power don't mean much.
Okay. they apply directly to it. First of all, there is no $1 trillion. It's only when you have an accounting culture, a Gutenberg culture, that measures cash. From that perspective, $3 trillion is missing. Now, anybody who brings up that story is outraged about where did it go and why didn't Rumsfeld look into it, and aren't they concerned? Because there never was any concern expressed about it. The thing is, the general perception is that, well, September 11th changed all that. Nobody could be bothered about it after that. We got worse problems. But the thing is, the $1 trillion, they had lost $2 trillion before that. And it's now up either after that or before it, I can't remember, but it's up to $4.4 trillion now. Yet nobody knows where it is, and nobody can find it, because there is no money, just like Enron had no money. It's a series of complex relationships of memes from different cultures and media interacting. So when you talk to capitalist societies, you have to pretend there's debts and credits and ownership, and those demarcating situations. But most of the economy is built on pension funds, which everybody is part of, and therefore we are more communistic than Marx ever thought of. The pension funds own the American economy. But that has to relate to other economies, which are not based on accounting. They're based on bartering and exchanging of huge media environments. So in that complexity, you end up with a company like Enron, which, being a chip body company, sold the TV body. It sold electric utilities, regardless of what happens to chemical body communities. And it moved those around the country. And because it was an older environment inside the chip body, and I would say because the chip body was collapsing, they could not control the old TV body as they collapsed, and it turned out they had nothing anyways. But they didn't need anything. Because for the accounting level of American private property meanship, they had to say that they were making profits, make their reports to the shareholders, and those profits came from loans given by New York banks. And when they were loaned the money, Enron was allowed to say that they were profits, but they were loans. And people will be shocked at that. These are madmen. No. When you're an international company, like a solar government-level company like Enron, and you're operating non-national landscapes like the TV body and the chip body, when you encounter the mean of nations, you've got to pretend you're making a profit for that meme.
Hmm.
And it's only in relation to that little puny ground, but in for the larger ground, they're selling electric utilities and causing brownouts in California that are creating havoc for the citizens, but that's a puny environment compared to all the environments Enron was involved in. So I'm trying to express the complexity of this interaction of these media environments and their memes and cultural biases within them, so that the simple accounting practices saying I have this amount and you don't are irrelevant compared to that, or very fragile. You get what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, and it's very interesting. And
yeah.
It kind of demystifies, because I'm one of the people who thought, how the hell did they think they could get away with claiming they had profits that they didn't have? And I mean, the guy obviously is not that stupid that he didn't think he could get away with it, but apparently he didn't anticipate the effect of the chip body collapsing and couldn't control that.
That's right. And if you look at the documentary on Enron, you watch how the narrator, you know, the non-capitalist or whatever they are, narrate and show how evil or silly Enron is. If you understand my way of looking at it, you have a whole different way of looking at the data that the documentary presents you. It makes it better, more, well, not necessarily better, a more comprehensive, interesting way of looking at it, that if I was narrating the movie, they wouldn't even understand it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
But they have to put it in simple American citizen terms, and it looks like this.
Yeah, everybody demands accountability, so tell us what happened, so we'll just tell you on terms that you want to hear, and everybody will be happy.
Right, and you have the level of non-believing information is such that when Ken Lay died the other day, the New York Post headline was, El Chito, check the coffin.
check the coffin?
Yeah.
What does the word check refer to in that?
C-H-E-C-K. They mean that when the guy is buried, check to see if he's really in there.
Oh, check the coffin.
Check to see if the body's in there. They suspected that Kenley faked the suicide.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, there's that level of cynicism in people who put out information every day that they want you to believe. But
yeah.
They know that information is a stable, non-transient entity, is obsolete. And when it's necessary to point that out, they say it. And I heard commentators in different media saying they were shocked. Al Franken kind of people were shocked at the rudeness of the New York Post, the cynicism to say that, to disrespect this guy, you know what I mean? Even though they didn't, Al Franken, they had no respect for Al Franken.
Well, they're more than disrespecting some guy, it's disrespecting anything stable about law that we can trust.
That's right. And so, that you know, Al Franken and them are saying, you know, they should respect the family, and this guy died, you know, sad he died, even though he was a corrupt character. But the TV body, we'll call the New York Post the TV body, they didn't care about chemical body decency. They just did their humorous take on it. And
humorous or cynical? I mean, were they applying that this could be what really happened, or were they just doing a comic strip kind of humor?
I don't know. I don't know what they were up to, but it's that's what they wanted to present. I mean, the New York Post is considered, it's a Rupert Murdoch medium. It's cynical. It's right-wing. It's anti-liberal. It's yet it is not pro-corporate in that story.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so in light of what I said, which was interesting to you, reading the next quote, which is from M.R. Let me just see what that M.R. is. I want to see if this next quote relates to what we were just talking about. M.R., an interview with Marshall McLuhan on Russia from the McLuhan Dooline newsletter, June 1970. So this is a quote from one of his executive newsletters that he was sending out to subscribers. Very expensive newsletter. He started in the late 60s. He says, McLuhan says, electrotechnics, which is another word for mixed corporate media or electronic media, the interplay in the 60s of all kinds of satellite computer TV environments. So he has this term electrotechnics, which before he would just call electric media. Electrotechnics scrapped the Westerner's industrial technology and retrieved and flooded him with the primitive modes of awareness of pre-literate man. That is why all bureaucracies of all sovereign and national entities have collapsed in the West. It is the speed-up of information by telephone and telex, etc., that destroys bureaucracies regardless of geography or ideology. China and Russia, as much as France and the USA, experienced this collapse at the same time. At the time when the Berlin Wall went down, we showed this quote to the Prime Minister of Canada at the time, Brian Mulroney, and he was pretty impressed, and he said, I'll have to pay more attention to McLuhan, because he saw this predicting that the Berlin Wall would have to go down at some point. Now, there's even more, I think, in the article. I don't have it in the quote that goes into that, but basically,
what's interesting to me about this quote is saying, you know, the speed up of information by the telephone and the telex. Well, I mean, by the time we had the telephone, or before that the telegraph, information was already able to move at the speed of light or virtually instantaneously. So how
only
did
with the telegraph?
Yeah, but that's all you needed to move money around. So
right.
I'm not sure how new media added. No new media, regardless of whether it was radio or television, could move any faster than the speed of light. So you already had the implosion of the movement of information when you had the telegraph. I'm not sure how the addition of new media caused things to speed up any faster.
Okay. The McLuhan would quote Teilhard de Chardin, who said the telegraph was a biological electricity. I don't know if he said telegraph.
Electricity is a biological event.
Yeah. In other words, it's a new organism. And definitely McLuhan said that the telegraph was the beginning of the electric age. The first electric war. In other words, any war that happens under electric conditions is a civil war, a global civil war, a local war, because the global coverage is involved with it. So the first war under electronic global village conditions was the Crimean War in 1850s, and it was there that the first empathic figure of aristocrats going and helping poor soldiers in that, and that's Florence Nightingale. Nursing came out of the charisma that she got sending reports back, or journalists covering her treating the soldiers in the Crimean War, and because the electric environment, according to McLuhan's definitions of cool media, involve you, then you had this reaction by Florence Nightingale going, feeling involved with the soldiers, and then the imagery of her being sent out around the world involved other people.
Mm-hmm.
So she was like the first counterculture person, or person leaving their privileged estate and moving into a tough environment.
Mm-hmm.
There's been many movements of that since then.
Sure. And with Vietnam, when people saw, you know, the bloody massacres right in their own living room, it impacted the people's collective.
It created hippies. Just like the Korean War created beatniks. And so the you have this dropout phenomenon happening. So the electric age, the first dropout was Florence Nightingale, which created nursing. So now here's what's interesting. Telegraph means electric writing. So you can go, dit, 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 you know, the Morse code, and you can communicate. But then what happened